Chapter 1. Warp knows I've seen more than my fair share of emperor-forsaken hellholes in more than a century of occasionally faithful and dedicated service to the Imperium. But the ice world of Simia Orichalcae stands out in my memory as one of exceptional unpleasantness.
1. Simia Orichalcae. Despite my best efforts to track it down, the origin of this name remains obscure. It seems fairly safe to conjecture that the world in question was famed for the presence of some statue or effigy in a past epoch. But why anyone should have chosen to commemorate this particular animal in such a way remains a mystery.
And when you bear in mind that over the years I've seen the inside of an Elder Reaver citadel and a Necron tomb world, just to pick out a couple of the highlights, so to speak, you can be sure that my experiences there rank among the most terrifying and life-threatening in a career positively littered with hair's-breadth escapes from almost certain death. Not that it seemed that way when our regiment got its orders to deploy. I'd been serving with the Valhallan 597th for a little over a year by that point, and had managed to settle into a fairly comfortable routine. I got on well with both Colonel Castine and her second-in-command, Major Brocklaw. They appeared to consider me as much of a friend as it was possible to be with the regimental commissar, and the kudos I'd earned as a result of our adventures on Gravelax stood me in good stead with the men and women of the lower ranks as well. Indeed, most of them seemed to credit me, not entirely wrongly, with having provided the inspirational leadership which had allowed them to prevail against the vile conspiracy that had unleashed so much bloodshed on that unhappy world, and provided them with an initial battle honour to which they could all point with pride. At the risk of seeming a little full of myself, I did have some cause for satisfaction on that score, at least. I'd inherited responsibility for a divided, not to say mutually hostile, regiment, cobbled together from the combat-depleted remnants of two previously single-sex units who had disliked and distrusted one another from the beginning. Now, if anything, I was faced with the opposite problem. I was charged with maintaining discipline as they became comfortable working together, and the new personnel assignments started bedding in. Quite literally in some cases, which only made matters worse, of course, particularly when acceptable fraternization spilled over into lovers' tiffs, acrimonious partings, or the jealousy of others. I was beginning to see why the vast majority of regiments in the Imperial Guard were segregated by gender. Fortunately, there were very few occasions when anything harsher than a stiff talking to, a quick rotation of the protagonists to different squads, and a rapid palming off of the problem to the chaplain were called for, so I was able to maintain my carefully constructed facade of concern for the troopers without undue difficulty. Being ice worlders themselves, of course, the Valhallans were overjoyed to hear we were being sent to Simia Orichalcae. Even before we made orbit, the viewing ports were crowded with off-duty troopers, eager for a first sight of our new home for the next few months, and a chatter of excited voices had followed Castine, Brocklaw and myself through the corridors towards the bridge. My enthusiasm, needless to say, was rather more muted. "Beautiful, isn't it?" Brocklaw said, his grey eyes fixed on the main hololith display. The flickering image of the planet appeared to be suspended in the middle of the cavernous chamber full of shadows and arcane mechanisms, surrounded by officers, deckhands, and servitors doing the incomprehensible things starship crewmen usually did. There must have been a dozen, at least, of them buzzing about, waving data slates at one another, or manipulating the switches inlaid into the age-darkened wood of the control lecterns which littered the main deck below us. "Captain Durant," the officer in charge of the old freighter that had been hastily pressed into service to transport us from our staging area on Coronus Prime, shook his head.
1. Coronus Prime was a major Imperial base on the fringes of the Damocles Gulf, where the Imperial forces withdrawn from Gravelax were sent for reassignment. Presumably, the Munitorium decided it wasn't worth diverting a fully fitted troop ship to deploy just a single regiment, and commandeered a suitable civilian vessel for the job.
"If you like planets, I suppose it's all right," he said dismissively, his optical implants not even flickering in that direction. Of indeterminate age, he was so patched with augmetics that if it hadn't been for his uniform and the deference with which his crew treated him, I might have mistaken him for a servitor. It had been courteous of him to invite the three of us to the bridge, though, so I was prepared to overlook his lack of social graces. It wasn't until some time later that I realised that doing so was probably the only way he would ever meet his passengers, as he showed every sign of being as much a part of the ship's internal systems as the helm's controls or the navigator, whose quarters were presumably behind the heavily shielded bulkhead which loomed ominously over where we stood. Cynical as I was about such things, I had to concede that Brocklaw had a point. From this altitude, as we slipped into orbit, the world below us shone like an exotic pearl, rippled with a thousand subtle shades of grey, blue and white. Thin veils of cloud drifted across it, obscuring the outlines of mountain ranges and deep-shadowed valleys which could have swallowed a fair-sized city. Despite the poor resolution, I couldn't help searching for some sign of the impact crater, where a crudely hollowed-out fragment of asteroid had ploughed into the surface of this pristine world, vomiting its cargo of orcs out to sully it. "Breathtaking," Custine murmured, oblivious to the exchange. Her eyes were wide like a child's, the blue of the iris reflecting the projected snowscape in front of us. The clear light struck vivid highlights in her red hair, and like her subordinate, she seemed lost in a haze of nostalgia. I could readily understand why. The Guard sent its regiments wherever they were needed, and the Valhallans rarely got the chance to fight in an environment where they felt completely at home. Simia Orichalcai was probably the closest thing to their homeworld either officer had seen since they joined up, and I could sense their impatience to get down there and feel the permafrost beneath their boot soles. I was rather less eager, as you can imagine. I've never been agoraphobic, like some hivers, and quite enjoy being outdoors in a comfortable climate. But where ice worlds are concerned, I've never seen the point of having weather, as we used to say back home.
1. Despite his frequent references throughout the archive to his being native to a hive world, Kane never specifies which one. And most of the few details he gives about his origins are inconsistent. The folk saying he quotes here isn't recorded in any of the anthropological databases, but that doesn't necessarily mean much. It could easily have been common in one small section of his home hive, such as a particular hab level or underhive settlement.
"We'll get you down as soon as possible," Durant said, barely able to hide his enthusiasm for getting nearly 1,000 guardsmen and women off his ship. I can't say I altogether blame him. The Pure of Heart wasn't exactly a luxury liner, and the opportunities for recreational activities had been few and far between. The crew clearly resented their facilities being swamped by bored and boisterous soldiers, and the training drills we'd devised to keep our people busy in the few cargo holds that weren't stuffed with vehicles, stores, and hastily installed bunks hadn't been enough to let them blow off steam completely, and there had been some friction. Luckily, the few brawls which had broken out had been swiftly dealt with, Castine being in no mood for a repeat of our experiences aboard the Righteous Wrath, so I'd had relatively little to do beyond telling the freshly separated combatants that they were a disgrace to the Emperor's uniform and dish out the appropriate penalties.
2. Our experiences aboard the Righteous Wrath. A serious disturbance broke out on board this troopship shortly after Kane joined the regiment, and several troopers and naval provosts died. For further details, see his account of the Gravelax incident.
And, of course, when you have several hundred healthy young men and women cooped up in a confined space for weeks on end, many of them will find their own ways of amusing themselves, which raised the whole range of other problems I've already alluded to. Despite the constant irritation of dealing with a host of minor infractions, I wasn't particularly eager for our voyage to end. I'd fought orcs before, many times, and despite their brutishness and stupidity, I knew they weren't to be underestimated. With numbers on their side, and the orcs always had superior numbers in my experience, they could be formidably difficult to dislodge once they'd gained a foothold anywhere. And by luck or base cunning, they had found a prize on Simia Orichalcai worth fighting for. "Can we see the refinery from here?" Castine asked, reluctantly tearing her eyes from the hololith. Brocklaw followed her lead, his dark hair flicking against the colour of his greatcoat as he turned. Durant nodded, and apparently obedient to his will, a section of the gently flickering planet in front of us expanded vertiginously as though we were plummeting down towards it in a ballistic re-entry. Despite knowing that it was only a projection, my stomach lurched instinctively for a second before habit and discipline reasserted themselves and I found myself assessing the tactical situation before us. The slightly narrowed eyes of my companions told me that they were doing the same, no doubt bringing their intimate knowledge of the environment below us into play in a fashion that I never could. Within seconds, we were presented with an aerial view of the installation we'd been sent to protect. "That valley looks reasonably defensible," Brocklaw mused aloud, nodding in satisfaction. The sprawling collection of buildings and storage tanks was nestled at one end of a narrow defile, which would be a natural choke point to an enemy advance. Castine evidently concurred. "Place a few dugouts along the ridgeline there, and we can hold it until hell thaws out," she agreed. I was a little less sanguine, but felt it best to appear supportive. "What about the mountain approaches?" I asked, nodding in apparent agreement. The two officers looked mildly incredulous. "The terrain's far too broken," Brocklaw said. "You'd have to be insane to try coming over the peaks." "Or very tough and determined," I pointed out. Orcs weren't the most subtle tacticians the forces of the Emperor ever faced, but their straightforward approach to problem-solving was often surprisingly effective. Castine nodded. "Good point," she said. "We'll set up a few surprises for them just in case." "A minefield or two ought to do it," Brocklaw nodded thoughtfully. "Cover the obvious approaches and lay one here on the most difficult route. If they meet that, they'll assume we've fortified everywhere." "They might not care, of course. Orcs are like that. Casualties simply don't matter to them. They'll just press on regardless, especially if there are enough of them surviving to boost each other's confidence. But it was a good point and worth trying." "How far have they got?" I asked. Durant swept the hololith display around to the west, skimming us across the surface of the barren world with breathtaking speed. The broken landscape of the mountain range swept past, the higher peaks dotted with scrub, lichen, and a few insanely tenacious trees, apparently the only vegetation which could survive here. "Just as well, too, or there wouldn't be an atmosphere you could breathe." Beyond the foothills was a broad plain, crisp with snow, and for a moment I could understand the affection my colleagues had for this desolate but majestic landscape. Abruptly, the purity of the scene changed, revealing a wide swathe of churned-up, blackened snow, befouled with the detritus and leavings of the savage horde which had surged across it. A couple of kilometers wide, at least, it resembled a filthy dagger thrust into the heart of this strangely peaceful world.
1. Kloms. Kilometers. A Valhallan colloquialism Kane acquired from his long association with the natives of that world.
The resolution of the hololith wasn't good enough to make out the individual members of this barbaric warband, but we could see clumps of movement within the main mass, like bacteria under a microscope. The analogy was an apt one, I thought. Simia Orichalcae was infected by a disease, and we were the cure. "Seems like we've got here just in time," Castine said, putting all our thoughts into words. I extrapolated the speed of the orc advance and nodded thoughtfully. We should have the regiment down and deployed roughly a day before they reached the valley where the precious promethium plant lay open and defenseless. It was cutting it fine, but I was just thankful we'd get there ahead of them at all. Fortunately, they'd crashed in the opposite hemisphere, and that had given us just enough time to make the journey through the warp to oppose them. "I'll get everyone moving," Brocklaw offered. "If we get the first wave embarked now, we can launch the shuttles as soon as we make orbit." "Please yourselves." Durant somehow managed to make his immobile shoulders convey the impression of a shrug. "We'll be at station keeping in about an hour." "Are the data feeds set up?" I asked, while I still had some measure of his attention. He repeated the gesture. "Not my department." He inflated his lungs, or whatever he used instead of them. "Mazarin, get up here!" The top half of a woman almost as encrusted with augmetics as the captain rose on a humming suspensor field to join us on the command dais. The cogwheel icon of a tech priest hung from a chain around her neck. As we spoke, she, hovering roughly at my head height, the tunic she wore stirring unnervingly in the faint current from the air recirculators at what would have been level with her knees if she'd had any. "The one in the fancy hat wants to know if you've wired up his gadgets." "The Omnisire has blessed their activation," she confirmed in a mellifluous voice. Her hard stare at the captain told me his irreverence was an old and minor annoyance. They are all functioning within acceptable parameters.
Good.
Castine, to my mild surprise, was looking distinctly uneasy, her eyes flickering away from the tech priest whenever she thought she could politely do so. We'll have full sensor coverage of the planet's surface then.
As long as this old blasphemer remembers how to keep his collection of scrap in orbit, she agreed.
Once again, the two of them exchanged a look that confirmed my initial suspicion that their bickering was a sign of an easy familiarity rather than any genuine friction. A waving mechadendrite reached forward across Mazarin's shoulder, clutching a data slate, which he thrust towards the colonel. Castine took it with every sign of reluctance, all but shying away from the mechanical limb. The appropriate rituals of data retrieval are on this.
Thank you. She handed the slate to Brocklaw as though it were contaminated. The Major took it without comment and began scanning the files.
Waste of a perfectly good starship, if you ask me, Durant grumbled. But the money's good.
We're most grateful for your cooperation, I assured him. A troop ship would have been equipped to deploy a proper orbital sensor net, which would have been infinitely preferable, but the battered old freighter's navigational array would just have to do.
Our deployment was a hurried one, made in response to a frantic astropathic message from the staff of the installation below us, so we had to make do with what we could grab instead of waiting around for the right equipment.
You've got the easy job, Brocklaw assured him.
This much was true. The Peer of Heart only had to stay in orbit over the refinery, feeding her sensor data into our tactical net so we could keep an eye on our enemies from above. Given the size of the horde we'd seen, that was a comfort. It looked even larger and more formidable than my most pessimistic imaginings, outnumbering us at least by 3-1. On the other hand, we'd been on the defensive, which would be to our advantage, and they'd want to take the place intact, so we wouldn't have to worry too much about incoming artillery fire. The extra intelligence our orbital eye would give us would help immeasurably in deploying our defences to frustrate their attacks.
You call this easy? Durant asked rhetorically.
A sweep of his arm took in the humming activity of the bridge. Having half my systems rewired, trying to hold it all together. His voice trailed off as Mazarin floated away with a faint chah of disapproval, and something a little softer entered his body language.
Your tech priest seems efficient enough, I said, trying to sound encouraging. He nodded.
Oh, she is. Far too good to waste her time on a tub like this, really, but, you know, family ties.
He sighed, some old regret surfacing in spite of himself, and shook his head.
Would have made a good deck officer if she hadn't got religion. Too much of a mother in her, I suppose.
Startled, I tried to make out traces of a family resemblance, but the main feature they had in common seemed to be an abundance of augmetics rather than anything genetic. I took the first shuttle down, of course, as befitting my entirely unwarranted reputation for preferring to lead from the front. I'd be well undercover before the orcs arrived and should have my pick of the quarters planet side. I wasn't expecting much in the way of comfort in an industrial facility, but whatever there was, I meant to find it. In this, I had a valuable ally. My aide, Jürgen, who had an almost preternatural talent for scrounging, which had made my life, and no doubt his own, although I was careful not to inquire about that, considerably more comfortable than it might otherwise have been in our decade and a half together. He dropped into the seat next to me, preceded, as always, by his spectacular body odour, and fastened his restraint harness.
"Everything's in order, sir," he assured me, raising his voice a little so that it carried over the chatter of the troopers surrounding us, meaning that our personal effects had been stowed in the cargo bay to the rear with his usual efficiency. Despite his unprepossessing exterior and his apparent conviction that personal hygiene was something that only happened to other people, he possessed a number of positive qualities which few people apart from me were ever able to appreciate. From my point of view, the most important was his complete lack of imagination, which he more than made up for with his dogged deference to authority and an unquestioning acceptance of whatever orders he was given. As you can imagine, having someone like this as a buffer between me and some of the more onerous aspects of my job pretty much amounted to a gift from the Emperor. Add to that the innumerable perils we'd faced and bested together, and I can honestly say that he was the only person I ever fully trusted, apart from myself. The familiar kick of the shuttle engine igniting cut our conversation short. It went without saying that rather than military dropships, the Pure of Heart was equipped with heavy-duty cargo haulers, which had been hurriedly converted to meet our needs as far as possible. The end result was better than I could have reasonably expected, but was far from ideal. The front third of the cargo space had been partitioned off with a hastily welded bulkhead, and then subdivided into half a dozen decks with metal mesh flooring. Somehow Mazarin and her acolytes had managed to cram some 50 seats with their associated crash webbing into this space so that we were able to disembark a couple of platoons at a time. The rest of the hold had been left open to take our Chimeras, Sentinels and other vehicles, along with a small mountain of ammo packs, rations, Medicaid supplies and all the other stuff necessary to keep an Imperial Guard regiment running at peak efficiency. Looking around, I could see men and women hugging their kit bags, holding laser rifles across their knees, their faces half hidden by the thick fur caps worn in anticipation of the bone-biting cold on the planet's surface. Most had fastened their uniform greatcoats too. These were mottled with the blues and whites of Ice World camouflage, and I was suddenly acutely aware of what an obvious target my dark uniform and scarlet sash would make me out in that icy waste. No point worrying about it now, though. So I gritted my teeth and forced a relaxed smile as the first faint tremors of the hull announced that we'd started to enter the upper atmosphere. "Pilot's making the most of it," I said, half joking and raising a few grins from the troopers around me. "Must have been watching Attack Run in the mess hall."
1. Attack Run. A popular holodrama of the time, about a squadron of lightning pilots who shoot down an unfeasible number of enemy fighters during the Gothic War. I quite enjoyed it, although Mott, my savant, claims to have counted 437 historical and technical inaccuracies in the first episode alone.
Jürgen grunted something. He too was swathed in a greatcoat, but like everything else he ever wore, it contrived to look as though it were intended for someone of a slightly different shape. He suffered from motion sickness on almost every combat drop, but that never seemed to affect his fighting ability once he was back on terra firma. I suspected he was so relieved to be back on solid ground, he'd take on the enemy with a sharpened stick rather than have to face the possibility of retreat and being airborne again. This time, though, he wasn't the only one. The overloaded shuttle was being buffeted by the thickening atmosphere, bouncing around like a stone on a lake, and pale, sweaty faces were everywhere I looked. Even my own stomach revolted on a couple of occasions, threatening to spray the narrow compartment with the remains of my lunch. I swallowed convulsively. I wasn't going to compromise the dignity of my office, not to mention becoming a laughingstock among the troopers by throwing up. Not where anyone could see, at any rate. What the hell does he think he's playing at? Lieutenant Sulla, commander of 3rd Platoon and a sight too overeager for my liking, scowled, which made her look even more like a petulant pony than usual.
This is the celebrated General Jennet Sulla, at a very early stage in her career. Despite the illustrious reputation she was later to achieve, Kane tends to regard her with, at best, mild antipathy throughout the archive. We can only speculate as to why. My own feeling is that he considered her tendency to decisive action unnecessarily reckless, since it put the lives of the troopers under her command, and by extension Kane's, at risk. Ironically, it's clear from her own, almost unreadable, memoirs that she regarded Kane very highly, and as something of a mentor.
Nevertheless, the distraction from my somersaulting stomach was a welcome one, so I invoked my commissarial privileges and retuned the comm bead in my ear to the frequency of the cockpit communicator to find out. "Say again, Shuttle One." The voice was calm and methodical, undoubtedly the ground controller at the refinery landing field. The answering voice was anything but a civilian suddenly in the middle of a war zone without a clue as to how to survive, and clearly not expecting to. Our pilot, without a doubt. "We're taking ground fire!" The edge of hysteria in his voice was unmistakable. Any moment now, he was going to panic, and if he did, we were all likely to die. I doubted that our overloaded engines had any tolerance left for evasive manoeuvres, and if he tried, the chances were that he'd lose control completely. As if to emphasise the point, we hit another air pocket and dropped vertiginously for a handful of metres. There was nothing else for it. I unbuckled my seat restraints and lurched to my feet, conscious of Sulla's eyes on me. I grabbed the nearest stanchion for support.
It was embossed with an imperial aquila, which I found reassuring, and with its support I was able to take a couple of halting steps towards the cockpit. "Is that wise, Commissar?" she asked, a faint, puzzled frown appearing on her face. "No," I snapped, not having time to waste on courtesy, "but it's necessary." Before I could say any more, another lurch slammed my body weight into the narrow door to the flight deck, propelling it open, and I staggered inside. The overriding impression was one of flashing lights and control lecterns, uncannily like every miniature version of the ones on the Starship Bridge, and the bleak white snowscape passing below us at an alarming speed. The pilot stared up at me, his knuckles white on the control yoke, while his navigational servitor continued regulating the routine functions of the ship with single-minded fixity of purpose. "What's the problem?" I asked, trying to project an air of calm. "We're under attack!" the man shouted, raw panic edging into his voice. "We have to pull back to orbit!" "That wouldn't be wise," I said, keeping my voice level and grabbing the servitor's shoulder to steady myself as the shuttle lurched again. It just kept on adjusting controls with a complete lack of concern. Beyond the thick vision port, the bleak and frozen landscape hurtled past as serenely as before. I could see no sign of enemy activity anywhere. "We'd take hours to rendezvous with the ship if we abort on this trajectory, and we only have limited life support. You'd probably suffocate along with everyone else." "We have a safety margin," the pilot urged. I shook my head. "The rest of us do. You don't." I let my right hand brush the butt of my las pistol, and he turned even paler. "And I don't see any immediate danger, do you?" "What do you call that?" He pointed off to starboard, where a single puff of smoke burst briefly. A moment later, a small constellation of bright flashes sparkled for an instant some distance below and to the left, bolter shells detonating against the ground after some trigger-happy greenskin took a hopeless potshot in our direction. "Nothing to worry about," I said, almost amused. "That's small arms fire." The analytical part of my mind noted that the main bulk of the Ork advance was still some distance away, which meant we ought to be on alert for a small scout force attempting to infiltrate the refinery, which was now looming reassuringly in the viewport, or reconnoiter our lines. The chances of anything actually hitting us at this range are astronomical. One day, I'm going to learn to stop saying things like that. No sooner had the words left my mouth than the shuttle shuddered even more violently than before and pitched sharply to port. Red icons began to appear on the data slates, and the servitor began punching controls with greater speed and abhuman dexterity. "Pressure loss in engine number 2," it chanted. "Combustion efficiency dropping by 16%. Astronomical, eh?" Strangely, the pilot seemed calmer now his fears had been realised. "Better strap in, Commissar. It's going to be a rough landing." "Can you make it to the pad?" I asked. He looked tense, his lips tight. "I'm going to try. Now get the hell off my flight deck and let me do my job." "I've no doubt you will," I said, boosting his confidence as best I could, and staggered back to my seat. "What's going on?" Sulla asked as I buckled in and tensed for the impact. "The greenskins put a dent in us. There's going to be a bump," I said. I felt strangely calm. There was nothing I could do now except trust in the Emperor and hope the pilot was as competent as he sounded. I considered saying something to reassure the troopers, but I'd never be heard over the noise of the crash alarms anyway, so I decided to save my breath. The waiting seemed to take forever, but could only have lasted a minute or two. I listened to the chatter in my comm bead while the pilot read off a number of datum points, which meant nothing to me, but sounded pretty ominous, fighting down the growing conviction that we weren't going to make it as far as the pad. In fact, the traffic controller seemed pretty insistent that we would avoid the installation altogether, which I could well understand, as dropping an unguided shuttle into the middle of the Promethean tanks would end our mission pretty effectively before it had even begun. The pilot responded with a couple of terse phrases which managed to impress me even after 15 years of exposure to the most imaginative profanity of the barrack room, and I began to think we were in safe hands after all and might just make it. This impression lasted all of a dozen seconds. Then a violent impact jarred my spine up into the roof of my skull, driving the breath from my lungs. A sound uncannily reminiscent of an ammunition dump exploding echoed through the hull. I gasped some air back into my aching lungs and tried to clear my blurring vision as the screech of tortured metal set my rattling teeth on edge. I became gradually aware, through the ringing in my ears, that Jürgen was trying to say something.
"Well, that wasn't so,"
he began, before the whole ghastly cycle repeated itself another couple of times. At last the noise and vibration ceased, and I gradually became aware of the fact that we'd stopped moving, and I was still alive. I struggled free of the seat restraints and wobbled to my feet.
"Everybody out,"
I bawled.
"By squads, carry the wounded with you."
In the back of my mind, a lurid picture of overheated engines exploded into flame, tried to ignite a little beacon of panic, but I fought it down. I turned to Sulla, who was trying to stem a nosebleed. For that matter, I suppose we all looked a bit the worse for wear, except possibly Jürgen, as with him it was hard to tell.
"I want casualty figures ASAP."
"Yes, sir." She turned to the nearest NCO, Sergeant Lustig, a solid and competent soldier I had a lot of time for, and started snapping out orders in her usual brisk fashion. The door to the cockpit burst open, and the pilot staggered out, looking as bad as I felt. "Told you we'd make it," he said, and threw up on my boots.